Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. On our show today, you're going to get an insider's glimpse into the heart of a writer. You're also about to learn what it means to push into your pain and emerge as an overcomer.
I'm an American!
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom. Let's talk about it.
Welcome to Homefront. Today we have Chris Fabry. Chris is an award-winning author. He's a radio personality who hosts his own daily radio program called Chris Fabry Live on Moody Radio. He also is heard on Love Worth Finding, which is where I became aware of him. He and his wife have nine children, and he just wrote a book called Overcomer. So welcome, Chris.
Great to be here, Cynthia. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, first of all, you have me beat on how many kids you have. My husband and I only have seven. And when you explain you've got nine, I can tell when I mention to people we have seven kids, their brains are starting to calculate how many are mine and how many are my husband's. And so I have to give them some additional explanation that they're both same mom and same dad.
Yes.
So do you want to tell us what explanation you give to people?
Sure. People will look at us and think, well, what are you? Are you Catholic? Are you Mormon? And I say, we're just prolific Protestants here. my wife and I had our first child in 1985. We had our final puppy, our last puppy, in June of 2001, and there were no doubles or triples in there. It was all single births, and Andrea is the same weight, well, probably a little less now than she was when we were married, so boy, and I want to be her when I grow up.
That's hilarious. So you are a writer, and I would like you to explain to us, why do you write fiction instead of nonfiction? I mean, I like nonfiction. I feel like I don't even have time to read the stories that are true, much less the ones somebody's making up.
Yeah.
So what's the point of writing things that didn't even happen?
I think it's all about how you look at the world and how you are most affected. When I look back at as a child and then, you know, a teenager, young adult, the things that really connected with me on a deep level were fictional works, books, and then films as well. One of my favorite all-time novels is To Kill a Mockingbird. And I don't think that, you know, that story is fiction, but you can imagine it happening. And it was actually, as we've learned more about Harper Lee's life, it was kind of based on several things that happened to her. And I think what fiction does, or what fiction did for me, was it came around the back door of the heart and knocked in a way that a quote-unquote true story or a nonfiction story didn't do the same thing for me. I love reading nonfiction. I've written some nonfiction as well. But for me, the real heart change comes when I'm able to go deeply into a story like that. It's the same thing that happened to King David when Nathan the prophet came to him and said, there was this man who had a lamb, and then he tells the story, and David is so incensed by that, you know, it moved him so much that then Nathan, when he said, you are the man, it really convicted. It was like a double conviction. It hit him so hard to realize this emotion that I've had about what, you know, the terrible thing that this person did, that I am that person with Bathsheba and Uriah. So, you know, stories can do things to us on the inside, fictional stories, metaphors that are used, that nonfiction sometimes they don't get to that same level. At least that's what it did for me.
I agree, because think about this. Jesus spoke in parables frequently, and not only that, but when you think about it, the number one best seller is the Bible. What is the number two best seller of all time?
Wow, you've got me. What is it?
It's Pilgrim's Progress, which yeah. is fiction, but yeah. it's so true. Sometimes the way they say it, a word or a concept, and that's probably why God gives us dreams. I own a bookstore. I'm moving my bookstore, and I had a dream the week before we started to move that I was going to be going into surgery, and they're going to cut off my arm. And that was my way of telling myself how awful it would feel to have my bookstore shut down, not be able to help people, and that it's just amazing. So I'm really happy that you wrote Overcomer. And before we get into that, I just want to ask you, you're not too much younger than me. In fact, I read your biography. You were born in 61.
Correct.
And my husband and I grew up listening to Adrian Rogers. Did you meet him, and how did you land that job working for such a man who's changed so much of the country?
Yeah, I met him several times. We worked together, and most of the time I would be either in Illinois or Colorado. He passed away in 2005. So I would do interviews with him where we were linked by phone and both of us were recording. So it sounded like we were sitting in the studio. But there were several times when I was able to, you know, go into his office or see him at a National Religious Broadcasters Convention, that type of thing. And ask him some of those questions face to face. He was always a very warm person. I took three or four of my kids once down to Memphis, and we were at a Sunday service and then the Saturday night before that. And he was just so kind and gentle to my children, very open and giving with them. And he was always that way with me, even till I'll tell you what happened to us in, I think it was in July of 2005. He had just resigned from the church. He had gone into retirement, and he was having some health struggles or things that were going on that most people didn't know about. And so we did this rather innocuous back and forth conversation. And he started to talk about the silly little stories that he would tell Joyce that he would make up. He used to make up these stories for his own children. And now he and Joyce, you know, were there alone. And so he would just make up stories about this fictional family that he came up with. And he started to cry in the middle of the interview, you know, in the middle of time when he shouldn't be crying. And he said, you know, I'm really sorry for the emotion here. I don't know where that's coming from. Well, as it turned out, you know, he passed away then in November of that year. And there was just all of this internal stuff that was going on inside of him as he was thinking about, you know, his days here on earth. And we were all shocked. You know, he should have had 20 more years to do all of this writing and traveling and speaking and all that. And I really questioned God, you know, why would you do this? Why would you allow him to go this long and then pass away like that? And I had to fall back on what he prayed or what he preached all through his life, and that was the sovereignty of God. We don't understand these things, and yet we have to hang on to that hang on to him, which will never change. He knows the end from the beginning. So that was a real hard time to go through that transition. But his messages are just as relevant today as they were the days that he preached them. So I'm really glad to be a part of that.
They are as relevant. So let's talk about our lives now, the ones left behind. We're still here. I'm close to the same age. I was born in 59, you're 61. And we spent from birth to our mid-20s trying to figure out what to do. Then we spend the middle part of our life doing it. And now that I'm almost 60, I'm realizing there are a lot of things I will never have time to do now. So we have to release some of the dreams because we're not going to live forever. Like you were saying, Adrian Rogers even had to confront the fact that he's got to go when your number's up. We're all getting out of here dead. I mean, we're all going to be appointed to die at some time. Nobody is getting out of here alive. We all have a 100% chance of dying, each and every one of us. So here's a question for you. Here you are. You're at the pinnacle of your career, having written 81 books. You got Jerry B. Jenkins to help you, which is really special. But not everyone can find the bottom rung of that ladder to climb on. So what advice do you give to those who are wondering what they're supposed to do with their lives?
Well, if there's any part of you that feels like writing, and a lot of people come to me and say that, you know, I really want to write. I say start small and be faithful with what you're given, because I believe we are stewards of our time, our talent, and our treasure. We are stewards of that which God has given us to manage well. But I've never really thought about until the last few years how much of a steward we are of our own pain. And I believe God wants us to steward that pain well. And writing is one of those things that I use to kind of write hard and clear about what hurts, as Hemingway said, to really lean into that deeper thing and go there and allow God to work in me first and then through me with what I write. So for those who are saying, you know, I really like to write, start small. You don't start out to be a brain surgeon by, you know, cutting open the skull. You learn all the topics and all the subjects and go and move into that. Same thing with writing. Even though it looks easy, you want to start small. If you're learning to be a brain surgeon, you don't go in and first cut the cranium. You know, you learn all the subjects, and it's the same thing with writing. You start small, and then you get people beside you, behind you, to help you understand, to help you be able to see. Now, take it out of the whole writing thing, though. How do I figure out what it is that God has for me in my life and what I'm supposed to do with it? That is such a big question. That I like to move it into the small incremental. What does God have for me today? How can I be faithful to Him today? Well, first thing I need to do is to stoke that relationship, to get close to Him, to find out what it is that He wants me to understand about Him today. And the only way to do that, I believe, is to get into His Word, to begin to have that communication, that conversation with Him. And step by step, day by day, I think you find that, you uncover that thing that He has for you to do as part of the process. As He is conforming you to the image of His Son, He begins to show you these things. He doesn't keep it from you because He's, you know, mean or vindictive, but He allows you to move into the life that He has for you step by step, day by day, because if we knew everything that in His plan for us, if I knew everything in the plan that God had for us when I was in my 20s, I wouldn't want to go forward because there was an awful lot of bad stuff in there. You know, having 9 kids and all of the struggles that we have had with the children, and, you know, with choices they've made or with illnesses and all those types of things, you know, it's a tough thing. But if you take it day by day and you lean on Him and not your own understanding, then He makes it clear. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I'd say.
No kidding. We love our children dearly, But I've sometimes wondered, why do they give you a birth congratulations card instead of a sympathy card?
That's a good one. I got to remember that one.
And folks, if you're offended by that, it's because you've never had teenagers. And so give your friend with teenagers a sympathy card just to encourage them. It comes from leaning into my pain. Let's talk about leaning into your pain a little deeper, because that is an amazing concept that we in America are afraid of. And we have all these pain relieving pills and gels and creams and psychiatrists and all these remedies to get us out of our pain. And recently we had this, we're all recoiling from the news of the mass shootings in our country that just happened over the weekend. And this is so incredibly painful. You've spent so much time, though, studying families. Tell us what is causing this phenomenon and what is the solution?
Yeah. I was just having that conversation with a good friend of mine, Dr. John Kessler, who taught at Moody for a couple decades, 25 years. And we came up with, those are the two questions. Why is this happening? And what's the answer? Why? What is it that we can do to stop this? Why is it happening? Those are the normal everyday questions. And then you look at social media and you see how people get on whatever hobby horse they are on and ride that for a long time. And it just gets so frustrating because it keeps happening again and again. And we want answers. We want solutions. I think the overarching answer to this question is, unless we move toward God individually and corporately, there is no answer to this whole thing. There is no answer to the violence that plagues us. There, I saw Jack Graham, Pastor Jack Graham, and Greg Laurie saying the same thing. Without a revival, and what revival to me means, an awakening in the body of Christ that spills over into the culture of people saying, what in the world do these people have that I don't have? Until that happens, then we're going to keep seeing these types of things go on, because sin entered a long time ago. And it's working its way throughout the culture, throughout the country, the nation, and the world as well. So that's not a real hopeful sounding answer to you, but I don't think the answer is ultimately in laws. There are really good things I'm sure that we can do legally, with the policy decisions. We could make some really good changes about the way that we treat each other and talk to each other, civility and tolerance and all those types of things. Absolutely, we could do better on that. But I think until the heart is changed, what we have is a broken and a sick society that has no other way to answer these questions than self-help or 10 steps. And that's not going to work when it comes to, you know, the problem of sin.
You're right, Chris. I actually spent close to 17 years in the Missouri State Legislature and in local government. And every time there's a tragedy, people are always asking, what can we do? What kind of law can we pass that will make sure nobody ever gets hurt and to make sure nobody's ever mean to each other? And the sad truth, after I walked out of the state capitol for the last time, I realized that we can't pass enough laws to make the world a better place. It is God. I mean, you look at this debate, it's kind of nauseating if people watch what's really going on, because the end result for all the people on the bigger government side of the debate is, let's take away everybody's guns. Well, guess what? Cain killed Abel with a rock.
Right.
He didn't have a gun back then. He still found a way to make stuff happen. Have we become a nation of cowards? It is so clear that the general population needs to understand that we have an enemy, and it's Satan. He came to kill, steal, and destroy. And the only defense left is to reject the lies and promote civility and help people find God, because frankly, they're going to meet him pretty soon one way or the other. And what matters is where you're going after you die. So, yeah. And you might have studied the family more. I know there's some people saying it has to do with taking psychotropic drugs and none of these young men had fathers. They're all young men. Have you looked into what's happening in the aggregate to the family in America?
I've been as a person with a big family, you know, I've looked at that with a lot of interest personally. And I've had a lot of experts who have talked about these types of things. People know a whole lot more than I do. I keep coming back, though, to our desire for control and our desire to solve problems without God. You know, let's look at global warming or climate change or call it whatever you want. If I am able to control the weather in such a way that, or if I recycle enough, if that's the answer to all of the problems that are out there environmentally, then I can control this. I have no need for God. If I can figure out my life in such a way that I can push God off the throne and put myself there, then you can see the logical conclusion of that. But I think even people in the church do the same thing. You know, I have, in a lot of my, you know, faith walk, I've called faith being able to figure it out. You know, well, God, you know, this happened in my life. Well, God must be doing this so that that happens and this happens over there and everything happens so that I can have kind of a Joseph experience, get thrown in the pit and then thrown into jail unjustly. And then, you know, I rise to power and my family is all saved. They don't starve because of all this. You know, if I can fit it together, if I can put the puzzle pieces together, then I can work it all out. And that is faith. And there are so many things that have happened in my life that I have been a clue about what what God's plan was and what he was doing here. So figuring it out is not really faith. That's an idol. What I need to do is fully trust, fully surrender, fully submit to him, especially with these things that you just mentioned, you know, with all the stuff that's going on in the family. You got throw in the opioid, you know, addiction and all of that that's going on in the area of the country where I hail from. And you've got all of these big questions that I don't think that you get to the answer until you get to the spiritual part. And that's where a lot of people don't want to go, or they want to redefine that so that we don't really talk about the God of the Bible. We talk about something else.
But yet, if you discount our ability to argue public problems with the biblical lens, then you just disarmed us. We just lost our ability to communicate the real truth. We're all avoiding the core issue. And I love your book, Overcomer, because I don't want to make anybody sad. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea that we're going to overcome something. So without spoiling the book, I do want to say I love The War Room, because right. The War Room was about prayer. That was the defining moment when they decided, let's take this to the next level. The war room is the prayer room. So what is the pinnacle premise of Overcomer? What's the one point we're going to walk away from?
It is the question of who gets to define who you are. Is who you are based on what somebody else says about you? Is it based on how you feel on the inside? Or does the designer, creator of your life, your heart, does that creator get to define who you are? And can you place yourself, surrender or submit, if you will, can you submit yourself into the hands of that designer so that all of your identity comes from him rather than my feelings, my emotions, or what somebody else says about me? And for a lot of people, what they're going to do is they're going to see the coach and they'll see, you know, how he's striving to be the best in the state and all of that. And you can define yourself by your accomplishments, Absolutely, you can do that. Or the 15-year-old girl who has a bunch of problems in her life. Is she defined on what her peer group says about her, who she is? Or is God, who is on the throne, saying certain things in the first two books of Ephesians? Is that who she really is? I think everybody who goes in is going to see some character in the film that they identify with. And in the end, they're going to say, this movie's not about the coach. It's not about the 15-year-old girl, Hannah. It's about me and my identity and who God says I am. At least that's what I hope happens.
I hope so, too. And so many times when there are both a book and a movie, people frequently say the book was better than the movie. And that's because the movie's only 2 hours and the book might be 20 hours. So now people get a chance. We can all read the book before we go see the movie, although I hope everybody will do both. So give us a call to action. What are we supposed to do to make things better?
Well, I think that one person finding their identity in who God says they are, and the Kendrick brothers did a great job of going through the book of Ephesians, the first two chapters. I spent months and months on this, mining the truths of that. If you will agree with God about who you are in Christ and then begin to live that out, if you begin to live forgiven, if you begin to live loved, you're going to have a different relationship with the people online that we were talking about a little earlier. Those with the agenda that's coming in here, the political thing or throwing barbs this way or that way. If you lived forgiven and you lived love because of the identity that you have in Christ, it's going to change everything.
Good. Well, we're going to go live love. That's a good deal. Thank you, Chris, for that. And I hope that you go see the movie, read the book. Everybody listening to this show, this is our chance to make a difference and to learn what it's like. So, Chris, give us one last summary comment, and then I'm going to let you go on to your next half of the day.
Well, I hope you will be an overcomer. Just like with War Room, I hope you'll become a prayer warrior. With this, you take it the next step, the next level, to be an overcomer.
Just keep writing, okay?
Okay, Cynthia. Thank you so much.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.